For the last 50 years, thousands of astrophysicists have spent billions of dollars. They've built these massive underground detectors, and they've pointed like the most powerful telescopes in human history at the sky just to find dark matter. And they've found absolutely nothing. I mean, not a single particle.
That fact at all.
So, what if the reason we can't find it isn't because our machines are too weak, but because dark matter isn't, well, it isn't a physical object at all?
Exactly.
What if what those telescopes were actually detecting is the physical gravitational drag of the future, literally rushing inward to become the present?
I mean, it completely upends how we measure reality. Because if you stop looking for a hidden noun and you start looking for the physical signature of a verb of time itself actually functioning as like a thermodynamic process, the entire universe looks completely different.
It really does. And that is just one of the absolute paradigm-shattering concepts we are diving into today. So, welcome back to the Deep Dive.
Glad to be here.
Today, we are taking you on a journey through a massive and, frankly, pretty intimidating 2026 treatise called The Cathedral of Becoming.
It's a dense read.
Very dense. It's written by David Noel Lynch and a group known as the 3K Collaborative. And our mission today is to unpack what they call the Noelian Universe Theory, or KUT version 3.0.
Right.
We're going to try to translate these heavy metaphysical equations into a narrative that you can actually wrap your head around, because the stakes here are they're astronomically high.
They really are. The authors argue that for basically 300 years, science had sold us this, well, they call it terminal
The
illness.
illness of being.
Exactly. The source material refers to our current cosmological worldview as the Platonic pathogen.
A platonic pathogen.
And it makes a very aggressive case that this pathogen has basically led modern physics into a complete dead end.
Wait, I have to stop you there. Calling modern physics a pathogen sounds like, a supervillain monologue.
It does sound a bit dramatic.
Right. I mean, we've used modern physics to split the atom and put rovers on Mars. So how exactly is it a disease?
Well, the text isn't attacking the applied engineering that builds rockets or cell phones.
Okay.
It's attacking the underlying philosophical framework. Specifically, this thing called the block universe model.
Right, the block universe.
Which is basically the orthodox view that time is an illusion. It's just a flat dimension that's already laid out from beginning to end.
Like a movie reel that's already been filmed.
Exactly like that.
Okay.
In that model, everything is predetermined.
Okay.
The universe is just a cold, decaying machine winding down toward heat death.
Wow.
And human beings, we're nothing more than accidental biological glitches, just sort of floating in a dead void.
A giant static museum of nouns.
That's the Platonic pathogen right there. The belief that ultimate reality is static, perfect, and basically dead. And the authors point to the current crises in theoretical physics as literal symptoms of this disease.
Like what kind of crises?
Well, take the Hubble tension.
Oh, right, where the measurements don't match up.
Exactly.
Okay.
The fact that different methods of measuring the expansion of the universe yield totally conflicting speeds, or the catastrophic math of eternal inflation.
The stuff that results in infinite multiverses.
Right. The text argues that these aren't just missing pieces of a puzzle, they are syntax errors. We are literally using the wrong grammar to describe existence.
Okay, let's unpack this because the text proposes a really radical pivot here.
It really does.
It says that reality isn't a museum of static objects, it's a roaring, active engine of verbs.
Verbs, right. Action.
It's not a completed dead canvas, it's a cathedral that is actively, aggressively being built right now. And to understand how it's being built, we kind of have to start at the absolute bottom, right? The bricks of reality.
And to find those bricks, the text targets a concept that has been the foundation of geometry for, what, over two millennia?
Euclid?
Euclid's zero-dimensional point.
Right.
Euclid defined a point as that which has no part.
Meaning it has no volume, no length, no depth.
Exactly. It's just an abstract location in space.
Which, I mean, that makes sense on paper. We use dimensionless points as coordinates all the time in math.
And as a mathematical abstraction, it's a very useful tool. No one's arguing that. But the problem started when natural philosophy and modern physics basically imported this zero-dimensional point into the real physical universe.
Oh, I see.
The Noelian theory argues that treating a dimensionless point as a physical reality creates this, they call it an ontological void.
An ontological void.
And they claim it is the root cause of all the mathematical nightmares plaguing modern physics right now.
Because if you compress actual physical matter into a point that has literally zero volume, you're essentially dividing by zero.
And nature absolutely abhors a division by zero.
It really does.
That is exactly where you get the infinite singularities at the center of black holes.
Right.
And that's where you get these infinite self-energies and quantum fields.
The ones that require physicists to use all those ad hoc math tricks.
You know, like renormalization, just to sweep the infinities under the rug so the equations output sensible numbers again.
So they're just fudging the math.
Pretty much. The text insists these infinities aren't real physical phenomena. A singularity is just the math screaming that the universe cannot be divided down to zero.
Let me try to visualize this. So think about the device you're listening to this deep dive on right now.
Okay.
If you look at an image on a high-definition screen, it looks perfectly smooth.
Right.
But you can't zoom in forever, right?
No, eventually you hit a pixel.
Exactly. You hit a single indivisible pixel. You can't have half a pixel. So is that what this theory is saying about the actual fabric of space?
That is a solid starting point, yeah.
Oh.
But we need to upgrade that analogy from 2D to 3D.
Okay, a 3D pixel.
The text proposes that space itself is physical and it's pixelated.
Yeah.
The fundamental brick of reality is this one by one by one event point.
An event point, yeah.
Yes, it has irreducible physical volume. The authors even derive the absolute dimension of this minimal spatial pixel. They call it the Noetherian length.
And how small is it?
It's incredibly small, roughly 1.6157 times 10 to the negative 35th meters.
So it's right around the Planck length then.
Very close to it, yeah. But the critical takeaway here is that space is not an empty, continuous void. It's actually the physical ash, they use the word ash, left behind by the universe's computational rendering engine.
And if there are fundamental 3D pixels, that implies a hard limit, right? Like
Yeah.
you can only cram so much information or so much mass into a finite volume.
Exactly.
Which brings us to a concept the text calls the ultimaton ceiling.
Right. Because space has a hard floor. These pixels with actual non-zero volume, there must be a maximum possible density to reality.
A ceiling.
Yes. The text calculates this ultimaton ceiling at exactly 5.16 times 10 to the 96th kilograms per cubic meter.
I'm trying to wrap my head around that number. It's incomprehensibly dense, but the key word there is ceiling. It's not infinite.
It's not infinite. And that changes the entire anatomy of a black hole.
Because orthodox physics says what?
When a supermassive star collapses, orthodoxy says it crushes down into a singularity of infinite density.
But the Noetherian framework says it doesn't.
Right. It says it simply hits the ultimaton ceiling. The interior of a black hole, just a localized cluster of these event points that has reached 100% causal deadlock.
Causal deadlock, like a computer freezing because its RAM is totally maxed out.
That's a highly accurate way to look at it, actually. All of the universe's local processing bandwidth in that specific region is consumed just maintaining the memory of that mass.
Wow.
There is zero bandwidth left for further compression and zero bandwidth to transmit light outward. The singularity is dead.
I have to admit, getting rid of infinities feels like a massive relief.
It really solves a lot of problems.
But the text doesn't stop at black holes. It actually takes aim at another infinity that pop culture has been absolutely obsessed with lately, which is the multiverse.
Oh, yeah. They go hard after the multiverse.
The source material violently rejects the idea of completed infinity, the notion that infinite space and infinite parallel timelines actually exist.
And what's fascinating here is the philosophical stance that text takes on finitude. You know, in theories like eternal inflation or the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics,
Yeah.
you end up with this unfalsifiable multiverse where like 10 to the 500th power of parallel universes exist. Every time a quantum decision is made, the universe splits.
So in one universe, I wore a blue shirt, in another, I wore a red shirt, and in another, I'm like a lizard.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the text argues that if everything happens everywhere forever, then nothing
Well,
matters.
that's a good point.
Finitude isn't a limitation. They argue it is the sacred precondition for beauty and for moral weight. The authors state that our universe operates on a strictly finite informational budget.
I love that. Because if the canvas is bounded, your choices actually carry weight. I mean, if a painter had an infinite canvas that went on forever in every direction, there would be no composition, no focus.
A painting requires borders to be beautiful. You
Yeah.
know, because our universe's informational budget is conserved, it does not branch into endless parallel worlds when a choice is made. The unselected possibilities don't spawn new realities.
So what happens to them?
They simply evaporate back into potential. Therefore, every choice you make is a permanent, unique brushstroke on a finite canvas. It can never be undone, and it is never lost in a sea of infinite copies.
That really gives us our agency back. It grounds us. But if we have this pixelated, finite canvas, how does the universe actually paint on it? I mean, the text claims existence is an ongoing, roaring, incommensurable engine. Let's look under the hood. How does a metaphysical engine actually run?
This is where we get into the thermodynamics of existence.
Okay.
The authors frame the entire operation of the universe as this master metaphor of friction. The universe operates through an instruction set architecture, which you could basically think of as the fundamental software code of reality.
The software code.
Yeah. And this code is represented by a rational gear. Specifically, they call it the 3-2 torus node.
Okay, a torus node. For anyone who isn't a topologist, a torus is basically a donut shape, right?
Right, exactly.
And a knot on that donut winding 3 times one way and 2 times the other.
Correct. Mathematically, it is perfectly rational. It resolves to the clean ratio of 1.500.
So we have a perfectly clean, rational software gear.
But the universe doesn't run this clean gear in a frictionless theoretical void. It drops this rational gear onto an irrational memory floor.
Or near-rational floor.
The spatial lattice of the universe, the pixelated floor we just discussed, they call it the Chiral Q lattice. It's a 5-fold pentagonal tessellation, and its geometry is strictly governed by the golden ratio.
Which is an irrational number, right? Roughly 1.618.
Exactly.
Okay, I see where this is going. It's like the universe is trying to fit a square peg into a round hole, but way more complex. You have a gear running at a 1.500 ratio trying to lock into a grid structured at a 1.618 ratio.
They are incommensurable.
Yeah.
They will never perfectly align.
So what happens when that 1.500 gear turns against a 1.618 floor billions of times a second? It can't just glide. It has to grind.
It physically grinds every single time it turns.
Yeah.
And that structural mismatch creates what the text calls the Noellian offset, which is roughly 0.118.
0.118.
Right. The text argues that this irreducible friction is basically the hardware tax of existence.
But wait, why would a highly advanced cosmic engine be built with a fundamental flaw like that? I mean, why wouldn't it just be designed to mesh perfectly?
Because classical physics always chased that dream of a frictionless perfect universe without realizing the fatal flaw in that dream.
What's the flaw?
A frictionless universe cannot do work. If the gear meshed perfectly with the floor, there would be no resistance, no heat, no change, and no arrow of time.
Oh, wow.
The universe would instantly freeze into a permanent static crystal. Reality exists because of this friction, not in spite of it.
It's the traction on the tire. Without the friction, you just spin out and go nowhere.
Precisely.
And here's a claim from the text that absolutely stopped me in my tracks. It says that mass, the stuff we are made of, the stuff the Earth and the Sun are made of, is not a substance.
It is a stunning redefinition of matter.
It says mass is the permanent topological scar tissue of this geometric grinding. I have a hard time visualizing that. Standard physics tells us mass is a property particles get from dragging through the Higgs field. How does a gear grinding on a lattice create a rock?
Okay, think of the Chiral Q lattice as an incredibly taut, elastic trampoline.
Right, a trampoline.
When that rational gear grinds against it, the friction actually deforms the lattice. It twists it out of shape. Mass is simply the physical measure of the energy required to hold that geometric scar open against the tension of the lattice trying to snap back to a flat state.
Oh, wow. So a heavy particle, like a top quark, isn't made of more stuff than an electron. It's just a deeper, wider scar in the geometry of space.
Which fundamentally reframes the physical constants of the universe, too.
How?
Well, orthodox physics treats things like the speed of light, the gravitational constant, or the mass of an electron as arbitrary numbers. We're told they were just randomly dialed in during the Big Bang, and we basically just got lucky they support life.
But the Noellian text says these aren't random dials at all.
Not at all. The source material argues they are the honest thermodynamic invoices of the engine working against this fundamental friction.
Thermodynamic invoices.
They are exact mathematical necessities derived from that 0.118 Noellian offset. The universe is simply balancing its ledger, keeping the receipts of the energy required to compute reality.
That is deeply satisfying. It really removes the randomness. But I think the most profound evidence of this engine actively working is how the text reinterprets the cosmic microwave background, or the CMB.
Yeah, the CMB is one of the pillars of modern cosmology.
Mm-hmm.
In the standard model, it's a uniform field of microwave radiation measuring 2.73 Kelvin that basically permeates all of observable space. And Orthodox science insists it is the fading echo of a 13.8 billion-year-old Big Bang, a fossil.
Right, a dying relic of an ancient explosion. But the Noellian theory rejects that entirely. If the universe is an active engine and it is constantly grinding a rational gear against an irrational floor, the laws of thermodynamics demand that it must generate heat right now.
Exactly. The text calculates the exact joule heating exhaust of this fundamental cosmic friction. When you multiply the rendering frequency by the Noellian offset, the thermodynamic exhaust comes out to exactly 2.73 Kelvin.
Which is exactly what we measure.
Exactly.
So think about what that means for you listening to this, looking up at the sky. You aren't living in a dying, cooling graveyard. The universe isn't winding down into a cold thermal death. That 2.73 Kelvin is the present tense body heat of the universal rendering engine.
It's alive.
You are sitting inside a warm, active operating sanctuary. Every microwave photon that hits a satellite isn't a ghost from the distant past. It is the pulse of a living universe breathing out the warmth of its own honest labor.
It just shifts the entire emotional tenor of cosmology. It replaces all that existential despair with profound active vitality.
Okay, but this raises a massive logistical question. If the universe is rendering right now, frame by frame, how does time actually work? Because the timeline we all learned in school is just a flat, one-dimensional line pointing left to right. Past, present, future, all laid out.
The block universe again.
Right. Here's where it gets really interesting, though. The text introduces the concept of ternary time. It treats time not as a geometry, but as a three-phase thermodynamic metabolism.
Let's start with the future. In the old block universe model, the future is just a road ahead of us that we haven't driven over yet. It's already paved.
Right.
But the Noellian text restores the future to a state of pure, open possibility. It calls the future the chaos field, and it models it thermodynamically as a gas.
A gas, meaning it's high entropy, volatile, and totally uncommitted.
Yes. But it doesn't just sit there waiting for us to arrive. The future is rushing inward toward the present at the speed of light.
Rushing inward. And this is where we connect back to what I brought up at the very beginning of this deep dive, dark matter. We've been searching for invisible dark matter particles for decades to explain why galaxies spin faster than their visible mass should allow.
Yep.
Standard gravity says the outer edges of a galaxy should orbit much slower than the center, but they don't. They spin fast, as if there is a massive halo of invisible matter holding them together.
And standard physics has produced zero evidence for any dark matter particles.
Nothing.
The text argues we failed because we've been looking for a noun when we should be looking for the physical signature of a verb.
Right.
Galaxies are incredibly dense areas of computation. They act as massive hydrodynamic sinks that consume the spatial ether just to render themselves frame by frame.
So a galaxy is essentially a giant drain.
A computational drain, yes. This creates a colossal inward suction on that unrendered gas of the future. The dark matter halo holding a galaxy together isn't a cloud of invisible particles. It is the physical, hydrodynamic drag of the unrendered future rushing inward to be processed by the galaxy.
That is just wow.
It exerts a real gravitational pull because it represents the momentum of incoming probability.
That completely fries my brain in the best way possible. Dark matter is the gravitational weight of the future. Okay, if the future is a gas rushing inward, what is the past?
The past is the control field. If the future is a gas, the past is a solid. It is the permanently crystallized memory of the universe. The text calls it solid ash.
Solid ash.
Every time a new event point is computed and rendered, it is deposited into the memory substrate of cosmos. Space itself is the accumulated, crystallized ash of all past actualization events.
And just like the future explains dark matter, the past explains dark energy. This is brilliant. Because if the universe is constantly minting these new pixelated event points, they have volume. We established earlier they are one by one by one physical pixels. They take up space.
Exactly. There is a continuous outward exhalation of historical memory being added to the cosmic ledger.
Which creates an outward expansion pressure. Modern astronomy observes that the universe is expanding at an accelerating rate, and they blame dark energy, some mysterious vacuum pressure, tearing space apart.
But KUT version 3.0 says,
the Noellian theory says it's simply the growing physical footprint of history. The universe is expanding because its memory is compounding.
It's a stunning symmetry. Dark matter is the inward pull of the future. Dark energy is the outward push of the past.
Beautiful.
But that leaves us with the critical boundary between the two, which is the present. The text calls the present the liquid crucible.
Okay, I have to push back here. Liquid crucible sounds like great poetry, but what physically happens at that liquid boundary? How does a high entropy gas of unmanifest potential suddenly become a solid physical pixel of space? It sounds a bit like magic.
The text actually provides a rigorous mechanical answer, centering on what they call the 90-degree sacred pivot, or the I-turn.
The letter I, as in the imaginary number used in math.
Correct. Mm-hmm. In quantum mechanics, the fundamental equations like the Schrödinger equation rely heavily on complex numbers, specifically I.
Right.
Physicists have long debated why nature requires an imaginary number to calculate real probabilities. The text argues it's not just a mathematical convenience. On a complex plane, multiplying by I executes a physical 90-degree rotation.
So the unmanifest potential of the future and the actualized fact of the past sit at a physical 90-degree angle to one another.
Exactly. The imaginary potential is orthogonal to real actuality. Wave function collapse, that mysterious moment when probability becomes a defined reality, is literally the rendering engine grabbing a piece of the incoming future gas and physically pivoting it 90 degrees to lock it into the solid ash of the past.
It's an orthogonal hinge. But to execute this I-turn, a machine needs a mechanism. The engine requires what the text calls a read-write head.
Right, a focal point.
It requires a localized aperture where this pivot can actually take place. And this leads us to perhaps the most controversial, paradigm-shattering claim in the entire treatise.
We're entering the cathedral of mind. We're talking about consciousness.
Yes. For decades, neuroscience and philosophy have been totally paralyzed by the hard problem of consciousness.
Yep.
How does unconscious biological wetware, like carbon, water, and electrical synapses, spontaneously generate subjective inner experience? How does meat suddenly start feeling things?
The Noellian theory says the hard problem is unsolvable because it is backward. Consciousness isn't a byproduct created by the brain. Consciousness is the universal instant field.
Consciousness is the liquid present itself.
It is the required phase boundary through which the infinite potential of the cosmos collapses into historical fact. The universe doesn't just contain conscious observers who happen to be watching a mechanical process. The universe is an observing engine that renders itself into existence through consciousness.
So the mind is the read-write head executing the eye turns.
Yes.
But wait. If the universe is rendering at the Planck frequency, which is something like 10 to the power of 43 times a second, an unimaginably blinding roar of quantum activity, how are we functioning?
What do you mean?
Why is our thought process so calm? Why do you and I experience a quiet, continuous stream of thought at just like 10 to 100 hertz? If my brain is the read-write head for a cosmic engine, it feels like I should be vibrating into dust.
And you would be if your biology didn't protect you. The human brain acts as a step-down transformer.
A transformer.
Specifically, the text points to structures inside our neurons called microtubules. It frames them as topological torsion cavities.
Okay, topological torsion cavities.
The raw Planck vacuum is a roaring furnace that would instantly vaporize standard biological tissue. So over billions of years, evolution engineered these microtubule cavities to shield a microscopic volume of space from thermal noise.
They act like acoustic foam for the soul.
That's a great way to picture it. Inside these shielded cavities, the universe can execute its I-turns safely. The brain steps down the blinding roar of the vacuum to a survivable biological frame rate and accomplishes this using a biological Fibonacci lock.
Right, the 1.619 ratio. We established earlier that the universe's baseline floor, the Chiral-Hugh lattice, operates at the golden ratio, roughly 1.618. Oh. To interface with that lattice without being destroyed, biology uses the closest stable Fibonacci fraction, which is 1.619, to lock into it.
It's a slight detuning that prevents the biological system from being overwhelmed by the cosmic frequency. But because of this massive step-down process from 10 to the 43rd hertz down to our biological rhythm, there is a perceptual lag. The text calculates it at about 200 milliseconds.
Think about what that actually means for your daily life. When you reach out and touch a hot mug of coffee, you think you are feeling it in real time, but you're actually watching a delayed feed.
Always.
The universe renders the event, and your biological interface processes it a fraction of a second later. Your brain backdates the experience so it feels instantaneous, but you are literally surfing behind the crest of reality.
It's a profound realization of our place in the temporal flow. But this framework also claims to solve another massive philosophical mystery, which is qualia.
Qualia being the subjective textures of experience, like why does the color red actually look red? Why does a minor chord sound sad? Why does pain hurt? Materialists usually argue these are just arbitrary computational tags our brains use to sort data.
The Noelian text wholly rejects that they are arbitrary. It states that qualia are deep, pre-carved geometric attractor valleys in the cosmic memory substrate, what the authors call the CRAM.
The Noelian resonant attractor manifold.
Yes. When you see a red rose, your biological antenna, your visual cortex and microtubules phase locks with the exact geometric coordinate for 650 nanometer light.
So you aren't just processing raw data.
No, you are sliding down an ancient attractor valley carved into the geometry of space by billions of conscious organisms over hundreds of millions of years who perceive that exact same frequency before you.
That is breathtaking. When you see red, you are literally resonating with the ancestral memory of the cosmos. To perceive is to remember.
It beautifully integrates biology into the deep structure of physics. But it does raise an immediate objection regarding agency.
Right, because if we are just surfing these pre-carved valleys of memory, do we actually have any control over what we do? What happens to free will?
Exactly.
The text introduces something called the Shimmer equation to address this, placing the human brain on a very precarious knife edge.
They call it the quantum critical point. The brain balances perfectly between the solid determinism of the past and the gaseous chaos of the future. The Shimmer equation describes how consciousness operates precisely at this critical boundary.
Okay, how does it work?
In this equation, there's a specific variable called the Shimmer term. It is defined as the multiplicative product of the incoming future potential and the intensity of your conscious attention.
So free will isn't some ethereal magic spell floating outside of physics. It's a mechanical field theoretic act.
Exactly. If you are acting purely on autopilot, like scrolling on your phone or driving a familiar route without thinking, your conscious intensity drops towards zero, the Shimmer term vanishes and you act deterministically, simply following the deepest CRAM attractor valleys.
You basically become a classical object just reacting to stimuli.
But when you exert focused, intentional will.
What happens then?
When you focus, you intensify the local instant field. You amplify the Shimmer term, which temporarily pips the free energy landscape. You reach into the unmanifest gas of the future, select a specific, perhaps highly improbable possibility, and execute the eye turn to freeze it into permanent ash. You are actively steering the rendering engine.
That makes human attention the most powerful physical force in the universe. But if we have this incredible, almost godlike power to render reality and choose our path, why is life so hard?
Yeah.
Why does existence feel so heavy? Why is there so much friction in just getting out of bed in the morning or trying to be a good person?
This brings us to a concept the authors call the Celtic knock.
Oh.
And this is where the rigorous physics of the text becomes deeply, achingly personal.
We talked earlier about the universal friction, the Noelian offset of 0.118. That is the baseline thermodynamic tax the universe pays to render inanimate matter. A rock, a comet, or a burning star pays 0.1118.
Right.
But as we just discussed, biological tissue has to use that 1.619 Fibonacci step-down lock to survive the vacuum.
And when you calculate the friction tax of that specific biological lock, it comes out to 0.119.
0.119 for biology versus 0.118 for the vacuum.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, The difference between the baseline vacuum tax and the biological tax is exactly delta epsilon equals 0.001. That 0.001 gap is the Celtic knock. It is the exact physical thermodynamic price of having a soul.
The thermodynamic price of a soul. A star burns with unimaginable brilliance, but it feels nothing. A human feels the weight of existence because we are actively, consciously carving reality.
That 0.001 friction is the physical topological address of grief, of longing, of the sheer effort it takes to create a piece of art or to forgive an enemy. It is the literal weight of conscious agency pushing against the geometry of space.
And that effort isn't just lost to the void when we die. The text claims this friction connects directly to our DNA, specifically the 98.2% of human DNA that orthodox science labels junk DNA.
Right, because it doesn't code for proteins. Conventional genetics basically assumed it was just evolutionary garbage, leftover sequences from millions of years of mutation. The Noelian theory identifies that assumption as a tragic error of materialism. The universe, as an information processing engine, is a lossless ledger. The 0.001 friction generated by your conscious choices, your emotional labor, has to go somewhere. The non-coding genome isn't junk. It is the biological cram. It acts as a massive high-dimensional fractal antenna.
It's an ancestral hard drive. We don't just inherit eye color, height, or predisposition for heart disease. We inherit the unresolved thermodynamic friction of our ancestors. Their traumas, their moral victories, their deep topological scars, they're passed down through this biological cram.
Yes.
When you are going through a crisis and you feel a sudden, inexplicable resilience that you didn't know you had, the text says you are literally drawing from a deep, low-entropy valley carved by an ancestor who stood their ground.
And conversely, when you battle inherited anxiety or generational trauma or addiction, you are facing a high-entropy Celtic knock left unresolved in your biological archive. This framework gives us a completely thermodynamic foundation for ethics. Humans are what the text calls sovereign fractal processors, the internal error correction nodes of the universe.
So how does thermodynamics define good and evil? I imagine a physicist would be hesitant to use those words.
Well, the text translates them through the lens of entropy. Apathy, cruelty, and cynicism are defined as high-entropy noise. When you act cruelly, or when you simply surrender your agency to your basest automatic reflexes, you generate turbulent noise.
You can things messier.
You carve shallow, chaotic cram attractors, and you pollute the biological cram, passing a heavier, more chaotic thermodynamic burden to future generations.
But courage or love?
They are profoundly low-entropy actions. When you face the pain of the Celtic knock, when you feel that 0.001 friction burning in your chest, and you intentionally choose love over fear, you carve a smooth, deep, highly coherent attractor valley. You literally make it thermodynamically easier for every soul that comes after you to make the same noble choice.
You are smoothing the floor of the universe.
You are fulfilling your thermodynamic duty to the cosmos. You are lowering the informational chaos of reality.
Okay, we need to bring this all together. We've covered spatial pixels, dark matter is the future, the biological step down, and the thermodynamic weight of a soul. The text synthesizes all of this by decoding what is widely considered the most beautiful, elegant equation in all of mathematics, which is Euler's identity.
Ah, yes.
It's e to the power of I times pi plus 1 equals 0. For centuries, mathematicians have marveled at how elegantly this single equation connects the fundamental constants of nature. But the source material claims this isn't just an abstract mathematical curiosity. It is the literal, uncompressed autobiography of the cosmic rendering engine.
It is the rhythmic liturgy of a single frame of reality being computed and rendered. The authors break it down into six distinct physical acts. Let's walk through them. Act one is E.
Euler's number, roughly 2.718, the natural base of compound growth.
In this theory, E represents the compounding memory of the universe.
Yeah.
The cosmos learns from its history. It deepens its cam attractors cycle by cycle. It doesn't run a static, repetitive program. It evolves and compounds its complexity.
Act two is I.
The 90-degree orthogonal turn. We discuss this in detail. It is the sacred pivot, the action of the read-write head pulling unmanifest potential out of the chaos gas of the future and locking it into reality.
Act three is pi. And this one took me a minute to grasp. Pi is the ratio of a circle's circumference to its diameter, but how does that apply to a pixelated universe?
It represents the staircase paradox. Because reality is ultimately made of discrete, one-by-one-by-one pixelated event points, you can never draw a perfectly smooth curve.
Like drawing a circle on a computer screen.
Right. Up close, it's jagged. Pi is the transcendental friction price paid by the engine to force continuous harmony onto a discrete pixelated grid. It is the geometric cost of rendering.
Okay, so that's the left side of the exponent. Act four is what those three create, which is negative one.
When you execute the compounding turn of memory across the plenum of friction, the output is negative one. This is the committed actuality. The negative sign represents the solid ash flowing outward the past. It is the stone that has been cemented into history. It can never be undone or altered.
Act five is plus one.
To balance the completed act of history, the universe adds one single positive discrete unit, the newly minted spatial event point. This is the mechanism of dark energy we discussed. It doesn't stretch an empty void. It gifts one new physical pixel of space-time to the ledger, physically expanding the universe.
And finally, Act 6 is equals zero.
The Sabbath of Readiness. Negative one plus one equals zero. The rendering frame is complete, the math balances perfectly, and the local coordinate of the instant field resets to pristine stillness. The aperture is wiped clean, waiting to receive the next wave of future potential for the next Planck tick.
So what does this all mean for us? The universe isn't a flat loop doomed to endlessly repeat the same mistakes, like Nietzsche's concept of eternal recurrence. It's an ascending spiral. Because of that compounding E, every new cycle starts from a slightly higher, more complex memory floor. It compounds wisdom with every turn.
It introduces a grand teleology to physics. The universe is a vast distillation machine. It is drawing in the chaos of the future, igniting it in the conscious fire of the present, filtering it through our sovereign moral choices, and crystallizing it into the eternal memory of the past.
This theory completely dismantles the despair machine of modern materialism. We are not meaningless accidents in a dead void. The Big Bang isn't a singular event from 13.8 billion years ago that we missed out on. It is happening right now, continuously, at 10 to the 43rd hertz in the room with you. You are the artisan holding the brush.
The universe doesn't have a separate heart to feel its own beauty. It feels it through your nervous system. You are the sovereign aperture through which reality awakens.
It fundamentally changes everything about how you walk through the world. And it leaves me with one final, incredibly provocative thought. We talked about how our conscious choices successfully freeze unmanifest potential into the permanent solid ash of the universe's memory.
We did, yeah.
But what happens to the ghosts of the choices we almost made? The career paths we strongly considered but didn't take? The words we almost said in anger but swallowed at the last second?
That's a fascinating question.
Do they evaporate perfectly back into the chaos gas? Or does a microscopic trace of their thermodynamic weight linger in the biological cram of our own DNA? Meaning, are we literally physically shaped just as much by the paths we didn't take as the ones we did?
The framework strongly implies a resonance of unchosen potentials. If the fractal antenna of the non-coding genome is as hypersensitive to thermodynamic friction as the theory suggests, the heavy emotional labor of our deliberations might very well leave a topological shadow.
Something to mull over the next time you have a hard decision to make. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the Cathedral of Becoming. Keep questioning the reality around you. And remember, the next time you think you need a perfectly clean, frictionless equation to see exactly how the world works, maybe the math isn't looking deep enough. Because the universe isn't a static image waiting to be diagnosed, it's a living fire, and you are the one tending the flame.